You're listening to Washington Post Live's First Look podcast with Jonathan Capehart.
Welcome to First Look, Washington Post Live's one-stop shop for news and analysis. I'm Jonathan Capehart, associate editor at the Washington Post. Looks like I've come back from vacation just in time for high drama on Capitol Hill as Mike Johnson puts his speakership on the line to get aid packages for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan passed by the House. Mariana Sotomayor, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, has been covering the ins and outs, and she joins us now. Mariana, welcome back to First Look.
Thanks, and welcome back to a crazy time.
Yeah, I've been calling it U.S. of Cray for a reason. So you've been reporting that Speaker Johnson's strategy now apparently is to divide and conquer. Bring us up to speed on where things are at this moment.
That's a very good way to put it, because as we remember many months ago, the Senate actually passed this foreign aid bill to make sure money goes to Ukraine, Israel, the Indo-Pacific, and there's a bunch of other little things in there, but those are probably the biggest parts. Johnson had said that that bill was actually dead on arrival in the House and really started to make a point that Republicans also had to pass border security as part of this bigger funding plan. And here we are, months later. We've obviously seen the world change a lot in the last several weeks, I would say even the last week or so. And that has added just so much urgency among House Republicans and Democrats to get something done on this front. You said divide and conquer. He divided that Senate bill because he wants it to go through regular order. And that sounds all good and great. However, as we know, House Republicans have had that consistent challenge of just that very narrow majority and a flank of hardliners, most of whom are in the far right, who just constantly vote against things because they're seeking this ideological purity. They want the most conservative bills. They want to pass the most conservative bills somehow through a Democratic majority Senate. And that's where you've seen these divisions come up. So Johnson really had to make a decision earlier in the week. He knew that if he moved forward with this plan, which, by the way, does not include border security, that's a big point of contention amongst Republicans as well. If he didn't move forward with it, he would get a motion to be vacated from the Speaker's office. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia, has been threatening that for some time now. But we know that that would happen if this bill actually, these several bills actually get through the House, which it's currently on track. We're slowly but surely on that track to pass those bills by tomorrow. And it's possible we can also see that motion to vacate Johnson tomorrow as well.
All right. So one of the reasons why these bills are now pretty much teed up for passage tomorrow is because of something extraordinary that happened in the Rules Committee. They can't vote on anything until something comes out of the Rules Committee. And I was trying to find the number. I think it was either four or all the, I can't remember how many Democrats are on the Rules Committee, but they voted for the rule. The Rules Committee is supposed to be where the Speaker of the House exerts his will, and yet he had about three or four Republicans vote against it. All the Democrats vote for it. Are Democrats now in control of the Republican majority?
Well, if you ask Democrats, they will absolutely say so. And I will actually point out, a lot of Republicans are kind of having an identity crisis over this because they also feel like Democrats are in charge of the majority. And as we've seen with Kevin McCarthy, it's the reason why he got ousted, among many other personal reasons for some members, and Johnson, they are having to rely on Democrats because, again, there's so many Republicans who just block the rule, and the rule just essentially allows for floor debate before final passage vote on whatever issue. They block that out of protest. They don't provide the votes at a certain point in time on bills, on issues that the Republican Party cares about. So there really is this pretty dramatic warfare within the Republican conference where, you know, the Republicans want to get things done. They want to address a number of issues on their conservative agenda. They can't do that. They can't even do the most basic things because a number of Republicans are blocking that from happening. That's exactly what we saw in the Rules Committee. Three Republicans who sit on there, two of them are part of the Freedom Caucus. One is Thomas Massie. He's a libertarian, doesn't really apply to any or fall into any one of those groups. they voted against the rule. We have not seen that happen in a long time in Rules Committee. So Democrats had helped them there, and they're going to help them, it's my understanding, along the way to overcome the rule vote on the floor and then be able to pass all of these bills, except the border security one, which will also be on the floor tomorrow.
Okay. And so what you just said tees up my next question. So if Democrats come to the rescue on the Rules Committee part one, and then come to the rescue in the Rules Committee part two, which will be either today or tomorrow, will Democrats come to Speaker Johnson's rescue when that motion to vacate is put on the floor for a vote?
Well, we haven't heard directly from leadership, Democratic leadership, that that is the case. However, we have been hearing for weeks, and Jeffries really did, the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries, leaned in on this last week and said, there are Democrats who would be willing to help Johnson if a motion to vacate happens after he puts a Ukraine funding bill on the floor. For Democrats, it really has always been a steady drumbeat of, we need to do the right thing. Johnson needs to do the right thing. House Republicans need to do the right thing and pass the Senate bill. All of these different bills are essentially that Senate bill just split up, as I previously mentioned. So Democrats are seeing a good faith effort, goodwill from Johnson and Republicans who will support this. I expect a number of Republicans will not support a number of these bills for many different reasons. So yeah, it is likely we should expect, because once that Ukraine funding bill it passes, that motion to vacate is likely going to get triggered, because that's what Marjorie Taylor Greene has said would be the trigger for her. And Democrats have said, we will help Johnson if he, again, moves Ukraine through to the Senate and for the president to sign it.
Okay. So, Mariana, help me out here. Help the viewers out here. If, let's say, all of this stuff happens, the motion to vacate from Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think also Congressman Massey also issued a motion to vacate. Did I read that right? Overseas?
He's also yes, part yes. Of this.
Right. Okay. So let's say Speaker Johnson survives with the help of Democrats. What would that mean for his speakership going forward? I'm trying to have a hard time understanding how he continues to be, sure, Speaker of the House in title, and he might have, you know, hands on the gavel, but would he really be leading?
Yeah, you know, I'm also trying to figure that out, because it really is an unprecedented time. This entire congressional term for House Republicans, the majority, has been pretty unprecedented. And Republicans are really starting to have that conversation, because, again, I had been hearing about this identity crisis that some Republicans are having of, well, if Johnson keeps relying on Democrats for votes, is saved by Democrats, and is still Speaker, then what does that mean for our agenda? What can we get done if literally we can get nothing done? Some Republicans look at it a different way. Well, we can get bipartisan things done, possibly. And, you know, go back to how the Founding Fathers had intended Congress to work, especially in divided government. So there's that optimistic point of view. There's others, I would say this is largely a majority of Republicans, who say, well, what needs to actually be done? What does the House need to do? Really nothing the rest of the summer. Obviously have to fund the government at the end of September. There's a farm bill that has to be reauthorized. But for the most part, the House and under Speaker Johnson has been able to pass through significant hurdles that had to get done. So there's some Republicans who are saying, well, maybe we just go back and campaign. Like, maybe we don't have to be in session all this time. And maybe Speaker Johnson does take a firm hand, get rid of those three members who voted against the rules in the Rules Committee, and maybe take out really disruptive members from their committees. There are some Republicans who are really looking for retribution here for those members who consistently vote no.
They're always fighting. But, you know, Speaker Johnson, you know, I remember you and I talking weeks ago about the speaker being afraid, doing everything he could to hang on to the speaker's gavel. And now it seems like he's not afraid anymore about his future. Listen to what he had to say in response to a question from our colleague Leanne Caldwell.
Listen, my philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. Look, history judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now, a critical time on the world stage. I could make a, you know, I could make a selfish decision and do something that that's different. But I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing.
So, Mariana, with the minute that we have left, if you could just, what accounts for that Speaker Johnson we just heard, a speaker who is, you know, seems to be very clear-minded, very clear-headed about what he wants to do and why he wants to do it?
It very much is a change. I mean, we've all been learning about Mike Johnson as a legislator, as a leader, including his own Republicans. And one of the things I consistently heard is he takes so long to make decisions because he wants to hear from everyone. He wants to please everyone. And that's literally impossible when you have a two-seat Republican majority and a lot of Republicans always going against you. So there was a meeting earlier this week where Republicans actually tried to make sure that Johnson could find a path that he didn't have to rely on Democrats. And that path did not exist. And it was made clear to him that if he just goes ahead with this plan, he will get ousted. So he really had to make peace with that decision. And, you know, talking to Republicans who obviously lived through McCarthy being ousted said that Johnson and McCarthy himself, they had to have like an evening to think it out, accept what was going to happen. And that's why you saw that change in tone, that press conference happened the following day, and you could see he was much more relieved and just, you know, willing to, as many have said, for Johnson, who is very religious, let go and let God.
That I had another question for you, but that is the perfect way to end. Mariana Sotomayor, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, as always, thank you for coming back to First Look. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Time for the opinions roundtable. So let's go to the opinion side of the Washington Post, where we will find Washington Post columnist Ramesh Panuru and Jason Willick. Ramesh, Jason, welcome back to First Look.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So before we get into the travails and drama involving Speaker Johnson, let's talk about the big news happening overnight in the Middle East. Israel conducted a retaliatory strike against Iran for last weekend's drone attack on Israel. The Post, though, is reporting that the strike seems to be limited in nature, and one Israeli official called it, quote, calibrated. Ramesh, was this the proper Israeli response, you think?
Well, I am a little bit reluctant to say in the absence of more information, but I think Israel did have to have a response. It couldn't just content itself with the essential failure of the Iranian attack. And I think that that the cautions that the administration raised about the nature of the Israeli response also made a certain amount of sense, which I think is real heated.
You know, Jason, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke to reporters from the G7 summit on the Italian island of Capri today, just actually more than about an hour ago, saying the United States did not participate in the Israeli strike and that the G7 countries are committed to de-escalating tensions in the Middle East. But doesn't it seem like all sides are looking to de-escalate tensions given how they are downplaying the strikes? I've been reading reports in multiple news outlets quoting officials in Israel and Iran and the United States that it doesn't seem like anybody has the stomach for having this, pardon the expression here, blow up bigger than it needs to be.
That's certainly how it seems. I mean, if you listen to what Iran's saying, they're, you know, basically pretending this didn't happen. You know, we don't really know exactly the extent of it because whatever damage was done, Iran is going to underplay. And the Israelis, like you said, are also being tight-lipped. So I do think that's the intention. I think Israel intended to send kind of an intimidating message. Look what we can do. Look how we can bypass your air defenses at will. And I think Israel also, you know, Biden was exhorting them to keep their response limited. You wonder if they got anything exchanged, maybe softening of President Biden's position on going into Rafah, for example, for keeping their response limited. But I do think, yes, the effort to prevent a regional war is pretty widely shared, except perhaps by Russia, for whom that might work out well. And I think that, you know, we're going to see it stay on a slow burn for now.
You know, Ramesh, is it possible that the Israeli strike will be the last of the tit for tat, or should we still be on guard for a dangerous escalation of this war?
Well, I think that there are people whose job it is to be on guard, and I suspect that they are on guard. I think that, though, at the moment, as Jason was saying, there is a certain confluence of interests in not allowing this to escalate further. That doesn't always prevent things from escalating, but yes, I do think that that's a realistic hope in this case.
This is something I would love to get your both of you to react to this. Ramesh, you go first. And the larger question of the Israel-Hamas war, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said on Monday, and I'm quoting, "There's a deal on the table that would achieve much of what Hamas claims it wants to achieve, and they have not taken that deal. The bottom line is they have rejected it." Why has Hamas rejected a deal? Ramesh, you go first. Why do you think? No, you're not at the table. I understand that.
Sure. So the State Department has sounded this note before, and I think it is an accurate one. And it's, it points to the difficulty of treating Hamas as though it is a normal and reasonable political actor that has limited and realistic ambitions. I just think that's just not what Hamas is.
Mm-hmm. Jason, do you foresee, I love your reaction, but also do you foresee any situation where Hamas one day shows up at the negotiating table and says, okay?
Yeah, no, I'm starting to wonder whether Hamas doesn't have the well-being of the Palestinian people as its top priority. That's a little bit of dark humor. I mean, I think, you know, they've wreaked devastation on the Palestinian people knowingly and with knowledge of forethought of what they were doing. And like Ramesh said, I mean, this is a fanatical organization. You know, they're trying to survive. They know that these hostages are basically their last hope of surviving. And so, you know, I've gotten kind of tired of these negotiations and the administration, you know, pushing Israel to negotiate, Israel reportedly softening its conditions and just getting rejected over and over and over. I think what's going to make Hamas negotiate ultimately is going to be more military pressure and possibly pressure from Qatar and the United States against its people, the people that it's negotiating with, and through, you know, Qatar and Egypt and other actors. But it's going to respond to being coerced. It's not going to respond because it wants to help the Palestinian people stop this war.
I don't know. I don't know, Ramesh or Jason, either of you can answer this question. But in listening to your last answer, Jason, I'm just wondering, there's a lot of attention on Israel at the negotiating table. There's a lot of attention on the United States and what it's doing at the negotiating table. But I don't hear a whole lot about what the Arab states are doing as, you know, trying to bring about a resolution to the Israel-Hamas war. Do the Arab states, are they an active participant in trying to bring about a resolution? I don't know if either of you has an answer. If you don't, we can move on to something simpler, like Speaker Johnson.
I mean, I think that they would love to, at least the governments of those countries would love to see Hamas destroyed as a, you know, Iranian radical proxy. But I also think that they, they don't want to be seen as supporting Israel, so they have to walk a fine line.
Ramesh, I saw you would try to get in.
Sure. I would just say that, you know, not just looking at this last year, but the last several decades, the Arab states' actual prioritization and real prioritization versus their rhetorical prioritization of the Palestinian cause is a pretty significant divergence, I think.
Okay, let's talk about Speaker Johnson. Ramesh, what do you make of Speaker Johnson's strategy of trying to get this foreign aid package past? Is it clever or is it desperate?
Well, he has found the cleverness and desperation. He's squared that circle. I think there is something to that, actually. I think that he may have just decided that given the sort of impossible situation that his own small and fractious majority has created for him, he may as well just do what he thinks is right. And so I think it may be that what he was saying in that press conference is the truth, that he's just decided to risk doing what he thinks is the right thing and letting the chips fall where they may, because it's not as though there are other options that are safer.
Right. And so then, Jason, so, you know, I played the clip earlier of the speaker, excuse me, from Wednesday, responding to a question from our colleague, Leanne Caldwell. He sounded resolute. He sounded, you know, I'm going to do the right thing. This is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for the country. And yet he still has hanging over his head, not one, but two members of his own caucus filing motions to vacate. They haven't put them to the floor for a vote. But do you think that they will actually, this is Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and Congressman Massey, do you think that they actually will follow through and bring those motions to vacate or a vote on the floor?
I would defer to what Mariana thinks. I think it's not certain. I mean, I think it's not certain because if it looks like they're going to lose those motions to vacate and they're not going to get rid of Johnson, then what do they get from it? I guess, you know, they'll get press attention and more donors, perhaps. But I think it's not for sure, just because they're threatening it, that it will necessarily happen.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ramesh, go ahead.
I think they will do it because I think they would like to see a situation where the speaker survives with Democratic votes. I mean, they'd prefer to maybe oust him, but if they can't do that, I think a second best outcome for them is driving him into the arms of the Democrats, which makes it easier for them to say he's betrayed Republicans.
I'm so glad you said that, Ramesh, because that's the question I was about to ask you. If you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Massey don't achieve what they want to achieve, which is vacating the chair, what does that mean for Speaker Johnson? Would he be a rhino speaker, Republican in name only speaker?
Well, you're already seeing that rhetoric from his Republican opponents, some of whom were pretty rapturous about his ascending to the speakership in the first place not too long ago, and have now decided that you know, he is, you know, pick your epithet.
And Jason, can Speaker Johnson effectively run the House if he is indeed Speaker, but a Speaker who is there because of votes from the Democratic minority in order to keep the Speaker's gavel?
I think the damage might be a bit overstated. I mean, there's a Democratic Senate, right? So any legislation that's going to pass out of Congress is going to need some Democratic support. So the idea that, you know, a purely partisan run House, could Republican run House, is going to get legislation through the Senate on its most partisan priorities, you know, is a bit of a stretch. Given the circumstances of divided government, if Speaker Johnson has to rely on a handful of Democrats, you know, it'll depend on the margin, right? I mean, if he loses a lot of Republican votes, sure. But if we're really talking about two people and you know, he has a one vote from Democrats he needs to get over the top, I mean, sure, it'll be a source of epithets, as Ramesh said, but practically I'm not seeing a huge impact.
Ooh, okay. I disagree. I think it'll be a hot mess if that were to happen. One more question. You know, given all the drama, then, what is the Republican argument to voters in November for why Republicans should remain in control of the House, Ramesh?
Well, you know, I think a lot of that is going to depend on what happens at the presidential level and what the message from the presidential candidates is going to be. And I think that, because voters put the presidential race at the top of their thinking of these issues, it'll be the House is there to implement the Trump agenda, right? I mean, but we don't yet know exactly what agenda Trump's going to run on.
Right. We've got 5 minutes left, and we're going to use that time to talk about the big social policy issue roiling the campaign, and that's abortion. Jason, you wrote about a boon the abortion issue has been for Democrats ever since Roe v. Wade was overturned in the Dobbs decision in 2022. But my question is, will it inure to President Biden's benefit in November?
Yes, it will. I mean, there's been some research that, you know, a large part of the Democrats' overperformance in the midterms shortly after the Dobbs decision, maybe, I don't know, a half dozen seats, something like that, had to do with the abortion issue. Democrats and, you know, pro-choice progressive groups have succeeded beyond their wildest dreams in these referenda. We're going to have more referenda on state abortion laws in Florida and Arizona, of course. I think Trump can still win those states, especially Florida, but it definitely raises the salience of an issue that Democrats have a polling edge on.
Mm-hmm. And for your part, Ramesh, you wrote that even though the public is more aligned with Democrats on this issue, Republicans need to start showing more spine. Explain that, please, because isn't that exactly what Republicans are doing? And it's what got them on the ropes now?
No, I think Republicans are basically following the path of least resistance. And when I say Republicans need to show spine, that doesn't necessarily mean taking the most anti-abortion possible position. So, for example, in Arizona, I think showing spine would involve switching the law to something that is more sustainable over time and in keeping with the consensus of the public. That requires taking on some of your pro-life allies and saying, look, a ban that it applies at all times and doesn't have exceptions for rape and incest is not something that we can sustain. They're not doing that. Their overall posture is just sort of hoping that this issue goes away and that they can talk about something else. And that's not going to work. The other thing stiffening the spine means is putting the cost of the political cost of the anti-abortion stance in perspective, because it's still the case that there hasn't been one pro-life governor or senator who has lost a re-election since Dobbs was decided.
I hadn't thought of that, Ramesh. Thanks for pointing that out. I want to pick up on something that Ramesh just said, Jason, and that is, you know, Republicans hoping the issue goes away. And one person who hasn't let it go away is the presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump, who one day said, you know, it should be up to the states. And then Arizona comes out and says the 1864 abortion ban is in effect. I'm just wondering, Jason, how do you evaluate Donald Trump's evolving position on abortion?
I actually think Trump is the avatar of Republicans wanting it to go away. I mean, he doesn't care much about abortion policy issue. He's saying he doesn't want to have a federal debate about it. And so therefore he's saying, you know, vote your conscience to people in the states and saying whatever the results of these referendums are, that's fine with me. And I think, you know, he's aware of the costs that this there's sort of a fight among some Republicans. What caused the underperformance in the midterm? Some people say it was the MAGA candidates, which certainly didn't help in a lot of states. Trump is more likely to say it was Dobbs, it was abortion, it was the refusal to moderate on abortion. And he has the credibility, it seems, with the Republican base as the president who appointed Supreme Court justices who helped overturn Roe v. Wade, to sort of be like a Nixon to China kind of person, the person with the credibility to moderate on an issue. I actually think, you know, it's not the worst path for Republicans to take electorally in November. I think Ramesh probably disagrees, however.
Ramesh, do you disagree?
Well, look, I mean, I think that as always with Trump, he's a mixed bag. From a conservative perspective on these issues, I don't think that the overall posture of pretend this issue doesn't motivate voters and try to run away from it is going to work. I do think that Trump is right about the need to moderate on some aspects of this issue in order to gain a foothold in public opinion. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're not seeing more complaints from Republicans about it.
And real quickly, you may have already answered this, but I'm just wondering, what is the argument to be made to, say, suburban women and young voters by Republicans advocating for bans on abortion? What's the message to them?
Well, personally, I mean, if they were asking me what their message should be, it would be something like, look, we have disagreements on what our abortion policy should be, but can we at least agree on, let's say, abortions in the third trimester and work on building a consensus from there through patient persuasion?
Well, you know, we're going to be talking about this a lot because we've got months to go before the November election. Ramesh Panuru, Jason Willeck, as always, thank you both very much for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Jonathan. You too.
Thanks for listening. To always stay up to date with the series, subscribe to Washington Post Live's First Look on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.